Hi, everybody. It's my first time at the CDC, but I'm sure some of you know me very well. I used to work for Merck, and now I speak out against the dangers that the pharmaceutical companies don't tell you about pharmaceutical drugs and vaccines. So when I was trained at Merck, which was a very intense training, we were told that all drugs go through a gold standard process, which is a double-blind, placebo-based, long-term studies. Well, for vaccines, as most of you know in here, they don't have to go through that process because they're categorized differently.
Hi, I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Most Americans don't know that in 1986, Congress passed a law that gave pharmaceutical companies complete immunity from liability for injuries caused by vaccines. The Zostavax vaccine is an exception. Zostavax is a vaccine that's supposed to prevent shingles, but instead it may actually cause shingles, vision problems, hearing loss, stroke, and even death. If you were injured by Zostavax, call me at Morgan & Morgan. I want to help you.
So determining causality really requires a double-blind placebo-controlled study, correct?
It does if you want to be certain, or at least a statistically strong relationship.
What do you mean by statistically strong relationship?
I mean a situation where you have a comparative group and you can say that compared to the comparative group that the association you're looking at is statistically different than the control group.
In 1987, I took an oath of first do no harm. And over the years, I've realized that there are conflicting information. There is conflicting information. There are conflicting studies about whether or not we may be doing harm to our children, their brains, and their immune systems. So I'd like to talk about a list of neurodevelopmental and chronic illnesses that we're seeing in children today. As you see from this slide, currently in the United States, we have 1 in 3 children who's overweight. We have 1 in 6 that has learning disabilities. We have 1 in 9 that has asthma. 1 in 10 with ADHD. 1 in 12 has food allergies. 1 in 20 has seizures. 1 in 45 males with autism. 1 in 68 with autism. And 54% of children have at least 1 of 20 chronic illnesses or are overweight. So what I'd like to do is to just show you where these studies come from, because the data are from published studies. So in the Pediatrics Journal in 2008, there was a published report showing that 1 in 6 children have at least 1 neurodevelopmental disability, including autism, seizures, learning disability, speech delay, PDD, NOS, learning disability, hearing disorders, and most of them are boys. So there's a 3-to-1, 4-to-1, or even 5-to-1 ratio of boys to girls suffering from neurodevelopmental disabilities. Something is happening to 16.7% of the children in our country. Mind you, this is 2008 published data. We are 9 years from these data. Plus, these data do not look at the developmental stages of children who are vaccinated compared to the developmental stages of unvaccinated children. All we know is 1 in 6, but we don't know between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated populations. So in 2012, the CDC put out a report, and it shows that 1 in 9 children has asthma, 1 in 10 with ADHD, and 1 in 12 with allergies. And many of you know that the number of allergies and the fatality of allergies has been increasing exponentially in children. And everyone keeps looking around and saying, what's wrong, what's wrong, what's wrong? Well, you can't put food proteins into vaccines, like casein from dairy or egg protein in the vitamin K shot or the MMR or the flu shot. And you can't put soy protein in the Prevnar vaccine. And you can't put what I think might be gluten in vaccines, or something that looks like gluten or is similar to gluten. And you can't put a castor oil in a vitamin K shot and expect that kids aren't going to have dairy, egg, soy, peanut, and possibly gluten allergies. So in January of 2016, a study was published showing that 1 of 20 children under the age of 5 is now suffering from seizures. What is a seizure? A seizure is high amounts of inflammation in the brain. And of course, in this 2012 CDC published material, 1 in 68 with autism, crossing all socioeconomic bounds, any wealth group, any poor group, any white group, any black groups, any Latino groups, any Asian groups, it crosses all ethnic boundaries. And then in 2011, there was a study looking at a survey done in children, over 91,000 children, and found that 43% had some form of at least 1 of 20 chronic illnesses, and when you took into consideration neurodevelopmental challenges as well as obesity, it rose to 54%. This is 2007. So 54% of children with at least 1 of 20 chronic illness in 2007, and here we are in 2017. So this is the new childhood in America, and are you concerned? Is there a problem going on? Is something going on in the immune systems and in the nervous systems of our children? So what are we doing to our children's brains? And you will hear unequivocally that vaccines are unrelated to any neurodevelopmental challenge that you might see in children. Most people, in my experience, read the title of an article and then spout the information in the title. They never go into necessarily reading the study to identify whether or not the study was done properly, who did the study, and whether the conclusions from the study are actually adequate. And in my experience, there's never been a study to show that vaccines don't cause autism.
Isn't it also the reason then that careful preclinical studies using an inert placebo should be conducted before licensure?
It would be ideal to do so, but one would also have to be very large studies and covering different age groups, and by and large, those data come out much later after experience with a vaccine used in thousands or millions of people.
This is an excerpt from the IOM's report, right?
Yes.
Okay. And this is where the IOM discusses the evidence with regard to whether DTaP or TDAP cause autism, correct?
Correct.
Okay. If you turn to the second page, can you read the causality conclusion with regard to whether DTaP and TDAP cause autism?
The evidence is inadequate to accept or reject a causal relationship between diphtheria toxoid, tetanus toxoid, or acellular pertussis containing vaccine and autism.
So the IOM reviewed the available evidence with regard to whether TDAP or DTaP can cause autism, and their conclusion was the evidence doesn't exist to show whether DTaP or TDAP do or do not cause autism, correct?
Yes, but the point is that there are no studies showing that it does cause autism, except one study by two well-known anti-vaccination figures, Geyer and Geyer, who have no legitimacy whatsoever. So what they're saying is that there's no evidence, and the important point from my point of view is that there is no positive evidence.
Right.
To do a proper study, as we've been discussing, which would disprove it, would involve the controlled administration of vaccines and withholding vaccines from children who should have them.
But since there's no evidence that DTaP or Tdap don't cause autism, you can't yet say that vaccines do not cause autism, correct?
I cannot say that as a scientist or a logician, but I can say as a physician that no, they do not cause autism.
Okay, so what you're saying is, as a physician or logician, then you couldn't say vaccines do not, you could not say vaccines do not cause autism. But as a pediatrician, you're saying that you would say that to a parent because you want to make sure they get the vaccine. Is that right?
You know, I can't be sure that DTaP doesn't cause leprosy. That doesn't mean that stops me from using a DTaP vaccine.
Are people claiming that DTaP has caused leprosy? Are you aware of any such complaints?
I'm not aware of any such complaints, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it on the web one of these days.
Okay, but people have made enough complaints about DTaP, Tdap causing autism that the Institute of Medicine at the commission of HHS thought it was serious enough to do a scientific review, correct?
Yes.
Okay. If you don't know whether DTaP or Tdap cause autism, shouldn't you wait until you do know, until you have the science to support it, to then say that vaccines do not cause autism?
Do I wait? No, I do not wait, because I have to take into account the health of the child.
And so for that reason, you're okay with telling the parent that DTaP, Tdap does not cause autism, even though the science isn't there yet to support that claim?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm also willing to tell them it doesn't cause leprosy.
Okay. Again, did the IOM review whether DTaP caused leprosy?
No.
Okay.
I cannot say that as a scientist or a logician, but I can say as a physician that no, they do not cause autism.
Because this scientist is lying to the world when he puts on his mask as a doctor and says, forget what I know as a scientist, and the product I made to inject into your children, and the aborted fetal DNA that looks like it's mutating your stem cells, forget about all that, just listen to me as a doctor telling you it's safe. It does not cause autism.
The most troubling aspect behind this plague of iatrogenic or doctor-caused illness and death is simply the active ignorance of the very artful terms that would otherwise describe the harm being done. What happens, in other words, when the power of words, the actual meaning of the words used in the scientific literature, are taken away even from doctors themselves, the ones administering the harm? For this purpose, we must understand the terms of art that are being used in the medical profession. Starting with the word harm, we of course find injury, hurt, damage, and detriment. But we also find moral wrong, evil and mischief, wickedness, a popular sense of the word as well. But when we come to the verb, the action means to hurt, to injure, to damage, to impair the soundness of the body, either animal or vegetable. And this is the definition that truly applies to drugs and vaccines, impairing the soundness of the body. As will be explained and documented fully, we find that the human and animal body, when untouched by man's devices and inventions, is truly armed against many of the diseases that otherwise would not be affecting the body. To be armed means to be furnished with weapons of offense and defense, furnished with the means of security, and fortified in a moral sense. And yet, we find that the poisons being delivered into our bodies unnaturally through injection, like a wasp stings its prey to deliver its venom, vaccinations are not arming us against disease, as the study just showed, but is indeed unarming the body. Nature equips us with arms, providing us the means of defense or attack, giving us army potence or power, potency from the Latin potentia or potential, giving us the power to defend ourselves against these disease states. Our potency is our physical power, our energy, our efficacy, our strength. And that includes moral power, influence, and authority, something that these industries and their government regulators have taken away from us. And soon even the power of choice will be taken away, leaving us impotent. To be potent, again, powerfully strong, forcible, and efficacious. But remember, this extends to in a moral sense, having great influence, especially over our own bodies and that of our children. Referring to authority, control, and dominion. Our potentness is our powerfulness, our strength, and our might against such forces that seek to destroy our potential. The potentiality, this power, this potency, this readiness of the body to defend, to be armed in its defense against disease, it actually exists in possibility. This is the idea behind the immune system. Once the immune system is triggered, then it comes into action. But that potentiality, the potential for the immune system to respond, is what is being destroyed through these drugs and vaccinations, as we will show. In fact, the term autoimmune disease means that the immune system is actually fighting against itself, releasing antibodies against your own body. This goes against potentiality, and this is what causes syndromes like autoimmune deficiency syndrome, AIDS, and other diseases, where the potential of the body to fight disease through the immune system has been impeded or halted altogether. Any disease is possible, and therefore your body must be in a potential state of action. It must be armed to fight all disease. What these drugs and vaccines have done is make us impotent. To act impotently is to act weakly, to have an immune system without the power to fight or even recognize disease. To be impotent is to be weak, feeble, wanting strength or power, to be unable by nature. Very important to understand that that is what we're talking about. We're talking about unnatural injections into the body of unnatural substances, drugs, which are compounds not found in nature. And therefore the body is unable by nature to fight disease or disabled by these drugs and vaccines from actually acting in a natural capacity, from being armed against disease. And make no mistake, vaccines are a delivery method for disease. To be impotent is to be wanting of power, the state of your body not having command over its own system of immunity. And it causes feebleness and infirmity, languishing under disease. And that brings us to the concept of innocence. To be nocive is to be hurtful or injurious. And similarly, to be nocent is to be hurtful or mischievous, injurious. In other words, doing hurt or harm. Coming from the word nocument, to harm. And therefore, to be innocent or without nocence means to be properly not noxious, not producing injury, free from qualities that can injure, harmless, innocuous, innoxious, as an innocent medicine or remedy, something not poisonous. free from guilt, not having done wrong or violated any law. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about the Hippocratic Oath. Are doctors free from guilt? Or have doctors done wrong and violated the law? The answer to that can be found simply by examining why it is that doctors have to have such heavy malpractice insurance. Malpractice. Bad practice. To be innocent is to be not tainted with sin, pure, upright, free from the guilt of a particular crime or evil action, as a man is innocent of the crime charged in the indictment, lawful, permitted. Unfortunately, when we permit someone to be unlawful, the unlawful action becomes lawful. This is what a license is. A license to kill or practice medicine, for instance. Again, being innocent is one that is free from guilt or harm. The term in no sense refers to a condition or rank, and therefore to act innocently is to do so without harm, a status of doing no harm, which of course brings us back to the Hippocratic Oath, an oath which we'll find out no doctor actually takes. To act innocently is to act without evil design or with simplicity. Often the natural course is the simplest course. As these words evolve, we get closer to the word inoculation. What is innocuous, meaning not nocuous, is what is harmless, what is safe, what is producing no ill effect, or what is innocent. And even back in 1828, it was understood that certain poisons used as medicines in small quantities prove not only innocuous, in other words, not harmful, but even beneficial. To act innocuously is to act without harm, without injurious effects to others. And that brings us to the word vaccination, or to inoculate. The verb or action of inoculation is to bud, to insert the bud of a tree or plant in another tree or plant for the purpose of growth on the new stock. And that is the very definition of spreading cancer. All sorts of stone, fruit, apples, pears, etc. may be inoculated. We inoculate the stock with a foreign bud. But more importantly, to inoculate is to communicate disease to a person by inserting infectious matter in his skin or flesh, as to inoculate a person with the matter of smallpox or cowpox. When the later disease is communicated, it is called vaccination. Now, to be clear, vaccination or inoculation is to specifically cause harm, to specifically communicate disease. In other words, to plant or bud disease into the body. This can be done in plants just as well as it can be done in men and in animals. Inoculation is the act or practice of inserting buds of one plant under the bark of another for propagation. And of course, just like a plant, a disease, a virus, a bacterium need to be placed in the proper host for propagation. That is vaccination or inoculation. It is the act or practice of communicating a disease to a person in health, making a healthy person diseased by inserting contagious matter in his skin or flesh. This practice is limited chiefly to the communication of the smallpox and of the cowpox, which is intended as a substitute for it. And of course, it directs us to vaccination for further understanding. The act of inoculating is budding, propagating, or infecting by inoculation, harming by inoculation. To be inoculated is to be infected by inoculation with a particular disease. This, again, is vaccination, but it is also many other drugs that are inoculated into your system. The inoculator, a nurse or doctor, is a person who inoculates, one who propagates plants or diseases by inoculation. Doctors and nurses are the planters of disease. This must be understood, remembering that we're back in the 1828 dictionary we can actually find here the origins of this ridiculous and unsanitary, harmful practice of vaccination. And that brings us to where the word vaccination or vaccine comes from, which in and of itself is shocking. A vacary, or Latin vacca, means a cow. Yes, vaccine comes from the word cow, an old word signifying a cow house, a dairy house, or a cow pasture. Vaccine, from the Latin vacca or cow, pertaining to cows originated with or derived from cows, as the vaccine disease or cowpox. Yes, the cowpox is called the vaccine disease. You believe you're getting a vaccine to prevent disease when the whole time the word vaccine means a disease called vaccine or vaccinia. Vaccination is the act, art, or practice of inoculating persons with the cowpox. This really had no other meaning in the medical community except to spread the cowpox from open cuts, open wounds of the cow into a healthy individual. That's why vaccine is literally called a disease, the vaccine disease or cowpox. To vaccinate, again from vacca or a cow, is to inoculate with the cowpox or a virus originally taken from cows called vaccine matter. What is matter? Pus. Pus, or the virulent viral material taken from an open wound. A pock is a pustule, like a zit or a boil, raised on the surface of the body in the variolous and vaccine diseases, named from the pustules, smallpox, or as it ought to be written, small pox. The pock contains the pus is taken and put into someone's body. This is vaccination. Pocky, to be infected with the small pox, full of pox or pussy sores, vile, rascally, mischievous, and contemptible. That's what it means to be pocky. Another word for this is grease. Grease was considered animal fat in a soft state, oily or unctuous matter of any kind, including pus, as tallow, lard, but particularly the fatty matter of land animals as distinguished from the oily matter of marine animals. Grease was also the swelling or gourdiness of a horse's legs occasioned by traveling or by standing long in a stable. To grease something is to smear, anoint, or daub with grease or fat. It also means to bribe or corrupt with presents. And finally, cowpox. Cowpox has one definition, and that is the vaccine disease. Now, when we examine the history, the photo evidence, and the satire at the time when vaccination was becoming a fad again, harming and killing many people because they were being infected literally, we can actually see how ridiculous the notion of vaccination is when we understand the origins of it. Here we see the origin of the vaccine virus, or cowpox, where the cow is actually cut in several places in order to produce the pus-like material, which would be scraped out or harvested from the cow, scraped off of the cow pustule by this sharp instrument, not a needle, more like a knife, and then the so-called doctor would cut the arm of the child, using the same blade on each child, and then literally poke that child with the infected instrument that the cowpox was harvested from. This, my friends, is the origin of vaccination. As we travel through history, we see this strange custom coming to life. Here again, the cowpox being harvested, the doctor scraping the pus directly from the cow, while across the room, another doctor's using that same instrument with the pus to poke it into the body.
Stay inside. time, lad.
Ah, so it's you. What is your name?
Charles.
Charles. Yes, Eve.
That's it.
Here we are. Put in the small card. Almost done.
This ludicrousy is the origin of modern vaccination. And in truth, it really hasn't changed much.
Smallpox vaccination with ACAM 2000. Introduction. With Dr. Brett Peterson.
Unfortunately, smallpox remains a threat because of its potential use as a biological weapon. This training video will assist healthcare workers and vaccine administrators to become familiar with the ACAM 2000 smallpox vaccine. ACAM 2000 is approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, for active immunization against smallpox disease for individuals determined to be at high risk for smallpox infection. Although this training video focuses on ACAM 2000, there are two additional smallpox vaccines maintained in the CDC's Strategic National Stockpile, or SNS. These vaccines are the Aventis Pasteur Smallpox Vaccine, or APSV, and Imvimune. Both vaccines are available from the SNS in limited quantities and would be deployed under the appropriate regulatory mechanism for investigational products. None of these three smallpox vaccines contain smallpox or the variola virus. Instead, these vaccines contain strains of the vaccinia virus, which is highly effective in immunizing individuals against smallpox. ACAM 2000 and APSV vaccines contain live virus from the New York City Board of Health strain of vaccinia virus and are replication-competent vaccines since they still have the ability to replicate in mammalian cells. Similar replication-competent vaccines have been shown to confer rapid protection against smallpox and have been used successfully in outbreak settings and during the worldwide smallpox eradication campaign.
This notion of prevention is the great logical fallacy of vaccination, a clever lie told that can never actually be verified. In science, it is a law that one cannot prove a negative. In other words, you cannot prove that something doesn't or won't happen. Science relies on positive, reproducible evidence. Yet all vaccine pseudoscience relies on one single fallacious appeal to historical evidence. That is that some of the vaccinated population did not get symptoms. The problem is, at the same time, neither did some, most, or even all of the unvaccinated population. A negative or absence is certainly not a proof of a positive or substance.
However, replication-competent vaccines have historically been associated with serious vaccine adverse events, and active vaccination lesions are considered infectious until the scab falls off. In contrast, Imvamune is a replication-deficient vaccine and contains the modified Vaccinia Ankara virus, or MVA. MVA is an attenuated strain of live Vaccinia virus that has lost its ability to replicate fully in mammalian cells, thereby potentially reducing the risk for serious adverse events related to dispersed Vaccinia infection and transmission of the vaccine virus from vaccinees to close contacts. The site of vaccination is the upper arm over the deltoid muscle. No other sites on the body have been well studied or approved by the FDA. ACAM 2000 smallpox vaccine is administered by the percutaneous route through multiple punctures to the skin using a bifurcated needle. Only the multiple puncture vaccination technique will confer the necessary immunity. Don new gloves before each patient contact and remove the stopper from the reconstituted vaccine vial. Remove the bifurcated needle from its packaging. Be careful not to touch the bifurcated pointed end. Submerge the bifurcated end of the needle in the reconstituted vaccine solution. The needle will pick up a droplet of vaccine within the fork of the bifurcation. We will now describe how to administer ACAM 2000 by the multiple puncture vaccination technique using a bifurcated needle. Deposit the droplet of vaccine onto the clean, dry skin of the upper arm over the insertion of the deltoid muscle. Hold the needle between your thumb and first finger perpendicular to the skin. Rest the wrist of the hand holding the needle against the individual's arm. Rapidly make 15 jabs of the needle perpendicular to the skin to puncture the skin, within a diameter of about 5 millimeters. The jab should be vigorous enough so that a drop of blood appears at the vaccination site. Following vaccination, cover the vaccination site loosely with a gauze bandage or other porous absorbent materials that can absorb exudates, and use medical adhesive or paper tape to keep it in place if needed. This bandage provides a barrier to protect against spread of the Vaccinia virus. After vaccination, vigilant hand washing and proper vaccination site care will be important to prevent the spread of Vaccinia virus. Recently vaccinated healthcare workers or individuals who provide direct patient care must take additional vaccination site precautions while at work. The vaccination site should be covered with an absorbent material such as gauze, along with an additional semi-permeable dressing to provide an additional barrier. Long-sleeve clothing to cover the entire vaccination site is also encouraged. Here is the multiple puncture technique again.
From MedicineNet, we read that the smallpox vaccine contains a live virus called Vaccinia. Now, to be clear, Vaccinia is cowpox, not smallpox. The so-called smallpox vaccine has nothing to do with smallpox. Healthcare professionals administer the vaccine by dipping a pronged piece of metal into the vaccine and then pricking the skin. And so the only thing that's changed is that the cow is not present for vaccination. What is smallpox? Smallpox is an infectious disease of the past that healthcare professionals eliminated worldwide by vaccination. This is a historical fallacy. In truth, most diseases were vanquished simply because suddenly there was plumbing. Suddenly there was running water. Suddenly people washed their hands.
Safe water and sanitation are critical. Without them, life is in crisis. Today, 884 million people have no clean water. 2.6 billion people have nowhere to go to the toilet. Half the hospital beds in developing countries are filled with people suffering from diarrhea caused by dirty water and poor sanitation. Diarrhea is the biggest child killer in Africa.
Worldwide, it kills 4,000 children every day, more than AIDS, malaria, and measles combined. 443 million school days are lost every year due to water and sanitation-related diseases. Millions of children waste countless hours collecting dirty water from distant sources. And if schools lack decent private toilets, teenage girls often drop out altogether. This crisis makes progress impossible. And yet there's a huge shortfall in funding. In 1990, 8% of aid was allocated to water and sanitation. By 2009, that had shrunk to just 5.5%. Governments across Africa recently agreed to spend 0.5% of GDP on sanitation. In almost all cases, this promise has not been met. Taps and toilets save lives. They are cheap, simple, and effective. For every dollar you invest in water and sanitation, on average, $8 is returned in better health and increased productivity. That's people well enough to earn a living. That's children carrying satchels instead of jerry cans. That's teenage girls attending schools with decent private toilets. Every day, up to 4,000 children's lives could be saved. All governments can do more to solve the water and sanitation crisis.
This global crisis of a shortage of clean water alone would prevent so many diseases. And this is a perfect example of the ridiculousness of vaccination campaigns, where instead of spending the money to fix sanitation problems and give people clean running water, governments instead spend money on pharmaceutical drugs and vaccines, when the whole time such diseases would be prevented as they were in history simply by providing clean water and proper sanitation. Again, vaccines do not prevent disease, especially when that disease is simply caused by unsanitary conditions. And so we could say that people don't get chickenpox because they eat Wonder Bread. There is no science behind the claim. Because once again, in science, you cannot prove a negative, and there is no science behind this claim. It then goes on to tell us that the variola virus causes the disease, and yet the smallpox vaccine contains cowpox or vaccinia. It's not even a vaccine for smallpox. It's a lie. In this research paper from the Stanford Education website, we read that vaccinia virus is a big mystery in virology. In other words, they don't really understand how it works. It is not known whether the vaccinia virus is the product of genetic recombination, or if it is a species derived from cowpox virus or variola virus by prolonged serial passage, or if it is the living representative of a now extinct virus. Vaccinia virus was used for smallpox vaccination via inoculation into the superficial layers of the skin of the upper arm. However, with the eradication of smallpox, routine vaccination with vaccinia virus has ceased. Recent interest in vaccinia has focused on its possible usage as a vector for immunization against other viruses. So maybe they're going to give us cowpox as a flu vaccination. As expected, 4 to 5 days following vaccination with vaccinia virus, or cowpox, a papule appeared at the site of vaccination. 2 or 3 days later, the papular lesion became vesicular, growing until it reached its maximum diameter the 9th or 10th day. During this time, the draining lymph nodes of the axial were enlarged and tender. Many patients also presented mild fever. The lesion dried from the center outward, and the brown scab fell off after about 3 weeks, leaving a scar, a mark, by which previous vaccines could be recognized. Literally, a mark of a beast is left over. But more importantly, unvaccinated contact with a vaccinated individual was the usual mode of transmission. This is very important, for when you get a vaccine, you shed the disease and are contagious for many weeks. And yet children are vaccinated and sent to school the same day. And yet it's the unvaccinated that we're supposed to be worried about. To be clear, vaccinated people are disease carriers, shedding the disease, and are very contagious immediately after vaccination.
I've got another study from Croatia, and There were several cases of measles outbreaks occurring in children who had just been vaccinated. And so they looked at they're having intensive surveillance of measles during this period of time. And so they looked at, with this DNA or genetic fingerprinting, what strains they were. And it was the vaccine strain that they were infected with. So not only did they become sick from measles from the strain that they were vaccinated with, but they were contagious. And this article, the key to this article is that it said that in the past, we would have never known this. It would have either been considered a different disease. It would have been contributed, like they would have said it was rubella or something like that. Or they would have considered that it was just a wild-type virus that the person was subsequently infected with before they had a chance to mount an immune response. But because now we have this added surveillance and this new technology that we can distinguish between strains, we're finding that these cases, we used to think that measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines didn't shed and didn't cause disease, but now we're finding that for all three of them, not only is the immune response not what we thought, but that for rubella and measles, at least for sure, I can tell you that those people are shedding virus, have the potential to shed virus and be infective.
And then there was generalized vaccinia, in other words, generalized cowpox, not smallpox, was characterized by a vascular rash that sometimes covered the entire body. This usually occurred 6 to 9 days after vaccination. How's that for a side effect? Generalized vaccinia was not associated with an immunodeficiency. The rash was usually self-limiting, and thus little or no therapy was administered. But the diseases that happen post-vaccination are vast and usually not kept record of. Neurological complications were the most serious ones that occurred from vaccination with vaccinia virus. Post-vaccinial encephalitis, or inflammation of the brain, usually occurred in patients over the age of 2, and was fatal within a week of the onset in 35% of patients. Accidental infection of some part of the body away from the inoculation site was the most common complication that arose from vaccination with vaccinia. Ocular vaccinia was a common manifestation of accidental infection. The point here is that the science behind vaccination for smallpox was Edward Jenner saying, hey, smallpox and cowpox have the same symptoms. Let's scrape the pus of a cow and stick it into the skin of a human and pretend that that actually cures the smallpox, of which we have no idea the origin of. That is vaccine science. And apparently, other than the production methods, it hasn't changed much. In an article from Medscape, we read that vaccination with vaccinia virus has been directly responsible for the successful eradication of smallpox, variola. They all say the same thing. Although the exact origins of vaccinia virus are uncertain, vaccinia may represent a hybrid of the variola and cowpox viruses. Vaccination with vaccine virus, that is, pus, produces a localized skin infection. In immunocompromised persons, vaccinia may disseminate and cause severe disease. The problem is that most of us have been immunocompromised by so many drugs and vaccines. But let's go back in history a little and look at the original anti-vaccine movement. When we look at the political art and satire at the time, we get a clearer picture of those who at the time would today be called anti-vaccination. In reality, they just don't want to get poked with cowpox, or cowpox. Here, an ad for Lancaster County Vaccine Farms. Yes, farms. They were farming these pustules, these pox, scraping the pus, and creating mass vaccinations. Here, it states that our farms are the largest, cleanest, and completest in the world. Our vaccine source, America's only authenticated case of spontaneous cowpox. And there you have the clean rooms where vaccines were harvested from cows purposefully infected with cowpox. Now, it is necessary to understand that vaccination was required. It was mandated many people didn't have a choice. They were forcibly infected or inoculated. Remember, inoculated means to harm or to infect with a disease. That is what vaccination is. Remember, vaccination comes from the word vacca or cow, and that the vaccine disease is the cow disease. Knowing that, we can look at this satiric portrayal of the inoculation called the wonderful effects of new inoculation, new harm. Here we see the devilish assistant with the benefits of vaccination in his back pocket, holding the vaccine pock pus bucket hot from the cow, and the doctor poking the woman with the pus. Meanwhile, in the background, those who have been vaccinated are literally growing little demon cows out of their orifices and out of their body parts. This is a reference to diseases and cancers that grew from the vaccination process, through the process of harm. In the background, we see the worship of the golden calf, which is also interesting, though we won't include that in this particular documentary. We find that many of the ancient gods were actually presented in the cow form, something you can research for yourself. And indeed, this portrays the vaccinators as worshippers of the cow, who wish to somehow integrate us with the cow. It's a very interesting history. And over here we even have the opening mixture bucket of pus mixed with something which creates a drug, quote-unquote, a compound of two or more things, and it's being directly fed to this gentleman who is the patient or forced to take the inoculation. Here we see the vaccinated calf, where it states that calves must be happy and contented, and that the performance causes the animals no pain. Well, perhaps I could shave you, cut you a couple hundred times, let you bleed and get infected, and then scrape the pus from your wounds, and see how happy and unharmed you are. This is a picture of the smallpox vaccine unit, or the preparation room, from 1918 at Sanofi Pasteur in Canada, speaking about animal matter, in other words, pus, the making of pure bovine vaccine at the Kennott Laboratories and Farm at the turn of the century. And here another disturbing satire of the vaccinators being chased out of town, where it states mercenary and merciless spreaders of death and devastation are driven out of society. Notice they're being chased out with their vaccination devices, complete with pus and blood. Also notice the dead and cowpocked children lying all around. Here the satire obviously shows vaccinations as death in the form of a venomous snake. And in this portrayal of vaccination, here the demon cow pustules, which are labeled pestilence, Pandora's box, plague, leprosy, and festered ulcers, are portrayed, where again we see infants being dumped by the bucket loads into the cow's orifice by demons, the vaccination knife in the back of his pocket next to his cow tail. And here the image of those now vaccinated infants being excreted from the cow's anus and shoveled into a cart. Bring out your dead. These were the first attempts or anti-vaccination campaigns to teach the common people the dangers and ridiculous notion of vaccination. And of course, while we hear of the great accomplishments of vaccination in the past, the true statistics are shocking. The amount of death and devastation caused by vaccines, a subject covered in Lethal Injection Part 1, is the true story, the true history of this ridiculous practice. Not the least of those was the polio vaccine. From the book Dr. Mary's Monkey, where a handful of prominent doctors stepped in to throw the weight of their reputations on the side of the vaccine. Dr. Alton Ochsner was a stockholder in one of the laboratories that produced the polio vaccine. He was so convinced that Salk's vaccine was safe that he decided to publicly inoculate his own grandchildren with the vaccine in front of the faculty of Tulane Medical School. Ochsner's grandson died of polio within 48 hours, and his granddaughter was crippled with it. Now, unfortunately, polio is alive and well. Another subject covered in my previous documentary, today in America, it's been relabeled as chronic fatigue syndrome. It is now 30 years since I have been confining myself to the treatment of chronic diseases. During those 30 years, I have run against so many histories of little children who had never been sick a day until they were vaccinated, and who, in the several years that have followed, have never seen a well day since. I couldn't put my finger on the disease they have. They just weren't strong. Their resistance was gone. They were perfectly well before they were vaccinated. They have never been well since. This from Dr. William Howard Hay, a medical doctor. Dr. James Martin Peeples, a PhD from Battle Creek, Michigan, in the year 1900, stated that today, the state stands behind the commercialized fee-hunting doctor to enforce his vaccination fraud against the lives and health of millions of little children. It is especially for the removal of this disgraceful compulsory curse that I speak as with a tongue of flame, that I make my earnest impassioned plea, restore the American citizen to his liberty in matters medical, as we have guaranteed his liberty in matters religious, and then, if the medical profession have anything specific of value to offer, the common sense of the people will come to know and adopt it. The further I looked into it, the more shocked I became. I found that the whole vaccine business was indeed a gigantic hoax. Most doctors are convinced that they are useful. But if you look at the proper statistics and study the instance of these diseases, you will realize that this is not so. To all the pediatricians in the world, please show me the study that found 69 doses of 16 vaccines do not cause cancer, autoimmune disease, and brain injury, says Dr. Jack Wolfson. Dr. Tony Bark, MD, says the kids that come to me from other practices and are fully vaccinated often are the kids, well, they are the kids in my practice with asthma, panic disorders, OCD, PANDAS, autism, and Asperger's. My kids who have never been vaccinated in my practice, I don't see those issues. I don't have one child who was not vaccinated who also has asthma or food allergies or Asperger's or autism or Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. Dr. Russell Blaylock, MD, states that tetanus vaccine is probably one of the most ridiculous vaccines ever. Your chances of getting tetanus are about the same as walking out of here and getting hit by a meteor. If you get a cut or puncture wound and you put peroxide on it, your chances of getting tetanus are zero because the tetanus organism is anaerobic, meaning it cannot survive in an oxygenated environment. Tetanus comes from the bowels of animals. As long as you don't have a sheep or a cow in your house, I don't think you're in any danger. Dr. Irvin Sinai, MD, states that the system is designed to create chronic disease. There's no money in being healthy. There's no money in being dead. All the money is in being chronically ill. And of course, doctors with pharmaceutical drugs are there to maintain that critically ill state, not cure. Remember, vaccines do not cure any disease. They do not cause immunity, nor do they claim to. Back to Webster's 1828 dictionary, we find the word virus, coming from the word virulent, or to be viral. A virus was considered the foul or contagious matter of an ulcer, a pustule, or in other words, a poison. Today we're shown sophisticated pictures of what a virus is, particles, proteins, bacterium, etc., that are viral or virulent, foul and contagious. The pus, or viral material, as shown, is the white or yellowish matter generated in ulcers and wounds in the process of healing. Again, the origin of vaccination is the cutting of the cow and then collecting the pus, or white and yellowish matter and blood generated in the ulcers, or the pox, the wounds in the process of healing. To be virulent, from the word virus or poison, comes from the same root as virio or venom from the snake. To be virulent is to be extremely active in doing injury, very poisonous or venomous. No poison is more virulent than that of some species of serpents. Very bitter in enmity and malignant. Venom, a word similar to the word venus, is a poison, a matter fatal or injurious to life. Venom is generally used to express noxious matter that is applied externally, as we just saw, or that is discharged from animals, as that of bites and stings of serpents, scorpions, etc., and poison to express substances taken into the stomach. Now, how do you get a cow to be venomous? Well, you use sharp instruments, scraping the cow venom or pus into the human body. To have such venom, metaphorically, is to have spite or malice. To venom something or someone is to poison, to infect with venom, in other words, to inoculate with vaccine, the vaccine virus, or any other ingredient found in such venomous syringes. To envenom is again to poison, to taint or impregnate with venom, or pus, or any substance noxious to life, to taint with bitterness or malice, as in malpractice, as the envenomed tongue of slander, or to make odious. Poison actually comes from the Latin pus, a substance which, when taken into the stomach, mixed with the blood or applied to the skin or flesh, proves fatal or deleterious by an action not mechanical, that is, something that is venom. The more active and virulent poisons destroy life in a short time, others are slow in their operation, others produce inflammation without proving fatal. In the application of poison, much depends on the quantity. And that's where we find ourselves today with the pharmaceutical drug industry. An overdose is simply too much poison. Poison is anything infectious, malignant, or noxious to health, as the poison of pestilential diseases, like cowpox. That which taints or destroys moral purity or health, as the poison of evil. To poison something or someone is to infect with anything fatal to life, to attack, injure, or kill by poison. And this is why doctors are labeled as the third leading cause of death, but in fact are the first leading cause, as we will show in triplicate within this presentation. But more importantly, to poison is to taint, to mar, to impair, to discontent the happiness of life. And that is why this presentation is called a corruption or taint of blood. For to poison is to corrupt. This can be through true poisons or taken metaphorically, as our youth are poisoned with false notions of honor or with pernicious maxims of government. To suffer such thoughts is to poison the foundations of morality. Back in 1828, it was perfectly understood that the word pharmaceutic or pharmaceutical referred to a Greek word which meant to practice witchcraft or to use medicine, that is, poison as medicine, pertaining to the knowledge or art of pharmacy or to the art of preparing medicines. And let us not forget that the word pharmaceutical is translated to the word sorcery in the Bible, where it states that the people will be destroyed through sorcery. In other words, destroyed through pharmacopoeia. But it was also understood then that witchcraft was a very real thing. It was not the Harry Potter pointed hat witch connotations that we find in today's Hollywood media. Witchcraft in 1828 was defined as the practices of witches, sorcery, in other words, those who use pharmaceuticals or poisons, potions, enchantments, intercourse with the devil. Now, the devil is, of course, a metaphor for anything opposed to nature, anything opposed to truth, a power more than natural. In other words, any compound or quote-unquote drug created by the pharmaceutical industry is not of nature. It is a power that is beyond nature because it is a compound created by men, not nature or God. The reason that medicine and other sciences are called an art is because they are being practiced in the second person, or in other words, under a flattering title. Unfortunately, much trust has been placed into the image of the doctor in the white coat and the stethoscope. Art is the disposition or modification of things by human skill, like pharmaceutical drugs, to answer the purpose intended. In this sense, art stands opposed to nature. And for the religious-minded man, that means opposed to nature's or God's design. An art, which the medical practice is a system of rules serving to facilitate the performance of certain actions, which is opposed to science, or to speculative principles, as the art of building or engraving. In other words, a doctor does not need science, does not need to be a scientist. He only needs the permission of the FDA to literally poison entire generations through drugs and vaccinations, through pharmacopoeia. As we saw in the previous pictures, there really is no science behind vaccination. Art refers to a skill, a dexterity, or the power of performing certain actions, such as mending bones or stitching up wounds. These are good arts. These are good skills. But when it comes to drugs and vaccines, doctors haven't a clue what they're doing, nor what the ingredients of those drugs and vaccines are doing to the human body. In 1828, the drug was known as the general name of substances used in medicine sold by the druggist and compounded, meaning two substances being put together unnaturally by apothecaries and physicians. This literally in ancient times was known as witchcraft, the making of potions, and yet somehow got formed into the art of pharmacopoeia or medical practice. A drug is any substance, vegetable, animal, or mineral, which is used in the composition or preparation of medicines. And it's very important to understand that a drug cannot be a single component, that a drug must be a compound of two or more things. Just what do doctors learn in medical school about vaccines? This article in the Vaccine Reaction gives us a good idea. The idea that there are medical experts who, by virtue of the MD initials placed after their names, automatically know more than anyone else about vaccines is pervasive. This commonly held belief persists, despite overwhelming evidence that doctors are taught almost nothing about vaccines in medical school. Doctors are taught that vaccines have saved the world from infectious diseases, and they are taught to follow the vaccine schedule promoted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, which tells them which vaccines to give and when. They're taught that they must always abide by the schedule and vaccinate every patient. That's pretty much it. Yes, it's hard to believe, but don't take my word for it. In an article I wrote several years ago titled Doctors Are No Experts on Vaccines, I included quotes from several medical doctors to back up my allegation. There is the following quote from biochemist Boyd Haley, PhD, who taught at the University of Kentucky Medical Center in Lexington, where he states, quote, I can tell you, having been in a medical center, having taught biochemistry to medical students, and talking to hundreds of medical doctors, they get very little training in toxicology. I mean, no courses that are specifically designed, such as a PhD student in toxicology would have, or a PhD student in biochemistry. They don't understand it at all. They are not trained to evaluate the toxic effects of chemicals, especially at the research level. One, they don't do research programs. They don't have the insight that's developed and required for someone writing a PhD thesis in toxicology or biochemistry of materials that inhibit enzymes. They just don't understand the science and the chemistry at that level. And certainly pediatricians don't, unquote. It turns out that this is just the tip of the iceberg. There are many testimonials by medical doctors and the professors who taught them regarding how little they learned about vaccines in medical school. It is important to listen to them so that the magnitude of the myth that physicians are the experts on vaccines can fully sink in. It is time to put this myth to rest, because it is too often used as a way to disparage anyone who dares to disagree or even mildly question doctors about the safety and effectiveness of vaccination. Case in point, an article published recently in The Conversation titled "Why Vaccine Opponents Think They Know More Than Medical Experts." The article is essentially a hit piece on anyone who refuses to toe the line and agree with, quote, medical experts. That the benefits of vaccination always outweighs the risks. The authors argue that anti-vaxxers may suffer from a cognitive bias known in the field of psychology as the Dunning-Kruger effect. They ask, quote, could the inability of anti-vaxxers to accurately appraise their own knowledge and skills compared to those of medical experts play a role in shaping their attitudes about vaccines? This inability to accurately appraise one's own knowledge is called the Dunning-Kruger effect, first identified in social psychology. Dunning-Kruger effects occur when individuals' lack of knowledge about a particular subject leads them to inaccurately gauge their expertise on that subject. Ignorance of one's own ignorance can lead people who lack knowledge on a subject to think of themselves as more expert than those who are comparatively better informed, unquote. You see what they did there? Of course, the problem with this cynical attack strategy is that it is based on a key faulty assumption, that the only way you can possibly know what you are talking about when it comes to vaccines is if you have gone to medical school so you can put MD initials after your name. According to Raman Ramos, MD, quote, the only thing we learned in medical school was that there was a program and that we should follow that vaccine program. As to the vaccine itself and the contents of the vaccines, no, we didn't study that. We assumed that what the pharmaceuticals, that what they did and the CDC accepted, that that's the way it is, unquote. Paul Thomas, MD, recollected, quote, we got a lot of microbiology, we learned about diseases, and we learned that vaccines were the solution to those diseases, that what they say are vaccine preventable. But actually, what was in the vaccines, I don't remember really learning anything. I was never taught, when I was in medical school 30 years ago, what was in a vaccine. We were only taught that they were wonderful, unquote. This lack of knowledge about vaccine ingredients and how vaccines can affect immune and brain function should be of particular concern to anyone getting a vaccine from a doctor. Quote, you'd be amazed at the number of physicians. You ask them, what's in a vaccine? Said neurosurgeon Russell Blaylock, MD. They'll say, well, there's the bacteria, the virus you want to vaccinate against. And then there's a little immune stimulant in there to help stimulate the immunity so they react against those viral antigens, unquote. But Dr. Blaylock points out, quote, they don't know about these other chemicals in there like formaldehyde, special proteins, lipids that are known to be brain toxic, that are known to induce autoimmunity in the brain. They're not aware of that. They don't know that MSG is in a lot of vaccines, monosodium glutamate, a brain excitotoxin. They're not aware of what's in the vaccine they're giving. Unquote. Quote, we learned what vaccines were, what the diseases were, said Joseph Mercola. We probably learned more about the diseases, and, of course, everyone accepted the dogma that vaccines work. There was just no critical analysis about the pros and cons. It was never discussed, let alone the side effects. Unquote. Quote, I don't remember them teaching me anything about adverse effects at all, said Patricia Ryan, MD. They just wanted you to memorize the schedule and make sure you knew when to give the vaccines. Unquote. James Neuenschwander, MD, recalled that when he went to medical school more than 30 years ago, there was, quote, not much training at all on vaccines. I don't know that it's changed very much, he said. Basically, it was, here's the schedule. These are the saviors of mankind. They are safe, and you need to make sure everybody's vaccinated. Unquote. Quote, we are told that vaccines are safe and effective. Here's the schedule. Ignore the inserts. That's lawyer jargon, recalled Cammie Benton, M.D. I think in medical school you're learning so much that it's kind of difficult to learn, that you assumed with vaccine the science was settled, tried and true. You just didn't question it. That was the easy part. Okay, this is for sure. You just accept it. Unquote. I could go on and on with examples of how doctors admit they are taught almost nothing in medical school about vaccines except to give them to everyone. But you get the idea. I'll end with an observation by Stephanie Krishner, a doctor of osteopathic medicine whose infant daughter did not survive vaccination. She said, quote, I never learned in medical school how vaccines were studied, what type of clinical trials they went through, how they evaluated adverse reactions, how they even evaluated effectiveness. So after Victoria, her daughter, died, I started reading everything that is put out there, anything that would lead me to a topic. Then I would Google that topic, and if there were textbooks in relation to that topic, I would order them, and then, based on reading that book, I would order another book. And what I have learned has shocked me. Unquote. In conclusion, medical school does not train future doctors to be vaccine experts. In fact, unless they took personal initiative and independently studied up on vaccines, those who graduate from medical school tend to be functionally illiterate about the subject. This aura of all-knowingness surrounding physicians, the common belief that they are vaccine experts, is wholly undeserved. That is why, increasingly, people are hesitant to rely solely on pediatricians and other medical doctors for guidance when it comes to vaccination, especially parents making a vaccine decision for their child. It has nothing to do with any kind of cognitive bias. It has to do with trust. Now, it's important to note that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention does offer immunization education and training modules, simply because these are not offered to doctors in college. Under the Immunization Education and Training website, we read, the CDC offers numerous education and training programs for healthcare personnel. A variety of topics and formats are available. All are based on vaccine recommendations made by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice, or ACIP. This group of pharmaceutical lobbyists and university professors will be expanded upon in the next part of this documentary series. And trust me when I say the conflicts of interests are maddening.
I've been reading about this a lot. As you know, medical doctors don't have a lot of training in vaccines. We don't have a lot of training in anything in detail unless you become a specialist. I've been reading about vaccines since 2009, about an hour a day. I started reading about vaccines when I saw my patients getting hurt. And that was really hard for me. I didn't want to believe it. In 2003, you all, literally everyone would have hated me. Biggest jerk of a jerk doctor you ever would have met, 2003. Biggest ego of any doctor I think that was ever created. And when I walked into my community, I told everybody how blessed you are that I'm here now. And in the next 2 years, I noticed that there was a separation in my patient population. There are patients that were seeing the local chiropractor that were healthier than my other patients, and they were doing some other things for their health other than just using medication for whatever condition they might have. They also had a lower vaccine uptake, and they were healthy, and that was really hard for me to recognize. My partially or unvaccinated patients, and none of us liked them, quite honestly, back then, they were going against their medical doctor's advice, and with the ego that I had, that was really hard to swallow. It took me a couple of years to start reading about vaccines, and the moment I started reading research about vaccines changed my life forever. I didn't know anything beyond the vaccine information statements, where we find out that vaccines are perfectly safe, you'll become immortal if you vaccinate, and if you don't, all the babies in the world will die. And that's what the CDC wants us to believe, and I understand why they say what they say. When I started reading vaccine inserts, I was blown away at what had been studied or not studied, at the numbers of kids that were studied, a study of 2,000 kids, and then we start vaccinating 4 to 8 to 12 million kids to see what happens. And it changed my life when I saw vaccines having a higher injury rate than what we expected. We had a brand new vaccine that would come out, and we'd start vaccinating kids. And instead of a 1 in a million reaction, we were seeing kids, you know, 1 in 100 being hospitalized, or having to create special rules that if you received a vaccine, you had to lay on the table for 20 minutes because you might pass out as you were leaving our clinic. Really hard for me. I am embarrassed to admit that I was still a vaccine bully, that in my practice we needed certain vaccine rates and you couldn't question my authority, but then I started to make personal decisions for my own children where we wouldn't give my kids any new vaccine that had just been released. A silly rule at the time for what I know now, but I was never going to test vaccines on my kids again. And in 2007 or 8, I forget, I experienced my first regression to autism with one of my patients. Now, you've all heard the same story, that they were born with autism and the doctor just didn't know that they had autism. And it's really hard to pick, no, that's not true. My background's in child development. I was working with kids with special needs. I had a perfectly normal child in my practice until they received his 12-month vaccines. When I walked into the room at a 17-month visit, I literally saw a child I'd never met before. I thought I walked into the wrong room. I stepped out to look to make sure I was in the right room because I did not recognize this child. He had regressed into autism, one of the saddest cases I've ever seen. And hard to admit that I struggled with recognizing that that really happened to my patient. I still know the child today. I'm working with him. He's doing well. But it opened up my eyes. That's when I started reading about vaccines. A few years later, we had a patient die after his shots. They called it a SIDS death at 2 in the afternoon, a few hours after his vaccines. I remember the discussion, and I don't want to violate any confidentiality, so I'm going to be very careful with the words that I use.
Sure.
The coroner asked the ER doctor, do you think this was related to the vaccines that the child had earlier today? And the doctor said, well, no, it wouldn't have been the vaccines, implying, of course, that vaccines are perfectly safe, so it was marked as a SIDS death, and everybody moved on. That family has peace. It was SIDS. It was unavoidable. It was just a random bad event. But that's when I started reading about vaccines. That led to a transition in who I am today. I also want to humble myself before you. I read about an hour a day about vaccines, and I work with moms in my practice that read 10 hours a day. They know more than I do, and that's amazing. And to all the medical doctors who are watching this, I'm sure they know more than you do. There are a handful of doctors in our country that know as much as these moms do, because once your child was injured by vaccines, you'll never stop researching it. I have all the stories in the world to share about patients in my practice, children who've been injured by vaccines and stopped vaccinating and working to recover, many, many, many healthy kids who have never had a vaccine, and some kids who are partially vaccinated. And doing this for 15 years now, I'll share with you that the vaccinated kids are the sickest, the partially vaccinated kids are not as sick, and the unvaccinated kids are the healthiest. Now, of course, bad things happen to kids. There are kids who are unvaccinated that still die. There are kids who are unvaccinated that still get leukemia and asthma and allergies and eczema, regress to autism, have developmental delays, everything in between. But the disease rates and the illness rates are highest in the vaccinated children. I am a faith-based person. I want to share that with you, that I'm really stressed about end times for me when I have to answer to what I'm doing with kids. Did I do my job by vaccinating or supporting unvaccinated kids? I'm going to have to answer that, because for what I've read, it's very hard to have peace with vaccinating children on the regular schedule. But let me share with you how I have peace, if that's okay with you.
Please do.
When children are vaccinated in our practice, they need a doctor who will recognize vaccine injury. And they're going to be vaccinated anyway, so I will watch them and I'll watch for the injury, and then we'll have that discussion. And if children are unvaccinated, they need a doctor who's been reading about vaccine influenced diseases. I don't say preventable, I say influenced. They need a doctor who knows what this looks like and knows how to treat the illness itself. And everywhere in between, in my heart, families need informed consent. I'm part of a group called Physicians for Informed Consent. We believe that it's very important that families understand that for any medical procedure, there's a risk or there's a benefit. And with that risk or the benefit, we need to have a discussion. And you do not have informed consent when you read the vaccine information statement. And you certainly don't have informed consent once you get the vaccines and your nurse gives you the statement after the fact. You have informed consent when you have an open, honest discussion with somebody who's actually trained to have the discussion with you. Then the family gets to make the decision. And after we chat, or after they chat with any one of our partners across the country, they choose to vaccinate, we're going to love them, we're going to pray for them, we're going to hope that it goes okay. They choose not to vaccinate, we're going to love them, we're going to pray for them, we're going to hope that that goes okay. But at the end of the day, they had true informed consent. I would love nothing more to have safe vaccines. I think that would be amazing if we had safe vaccines, or even if we had accountability for vaccine injuries. There are three things that I need before I'm going to jump on the pro-vaccine bandwagon. Number one, we need to have accountability to the vaccine injury for vaccine for the vaccine industry for vaccine injuries, right? You need to be able to sue somebody if they hurt your kid. As the only industry in our country where you have no option for litigation if somebody's hurt, because correlation doesn't mean causation, you got to be kidding me, right? Like, a kid falls over and they get a bloody nose. Yeah, they fell, they hit their nose, and their nose is bleeding. That was not correlation. We saw what happened. They got hurt. Vaccine injuries happen, whether it's immediately or years afterwards. We need to be able to hold people accountable. That's going to drive safety. Now, that's my, not my medical training or my pediatrics training. That's my master's in business training. You have to hold markets accountable for injury. That's how you have safety. That's why we have safe products in our country as best we can, because you actually get to hold them accountable and sue them when they're not protecting our children. The second thing is, we need to study vaccinated versus unvaccinated kids. We have plenty of people who would volunteer for that study that are vaccinated, plenty of people who are unvaccinated. We need to study that. We need to have placebo-controlled studies so we can see what happens if I inject you with nothing compared to vaccines, and have that up front, not after the fact, where we're trying to figure out what happened to our children. Once we have those things, including long-term outcome studies, right, because some of the stuff happens years, not moments afterwards. Once we have those, I promise you I'll be in the forefront of vaccinating children in our country. Once we have full informed consent for the providers as well. Until that point, we have to have a discussion. If that makes me a bad doctor, call me a bad doctor. We need to save and support our children and our parents' rights to decide what they're going to inject.
So one of the famous lines that you came out with was the amount of money that you do not make, because you don't choose money over life.
Correct.
And it was quoted around that it was 700,000.
Correct.
Where did that figure come from? Is that for your whole practice, or was that just for you as a pediatrician?
At the time, that was for me as a pediatrician with my patient volumes. When we calculated the profit margin, you know that there's a profit for vaccines, correct? There's a profit margin for each vaccine. And so as a business owner, again, business degree, pediatricians don't have business degrees, I calculated the profit of each vaccine that I give and the profit of each vaccine that families chose not to receive on that day. $700,000 is my lost profit because I don't make everybody vaccinate in our clinic. That number has gone up with the number of providers that we have. That number has dramatically increased because we cannot get a favorable contract with our insurance companies because we don't have a high enough vaccine rate. We're now up to about $1.7 million that our clinic does not make every year, lost profit, because we aren't playing by the vaccine rules. And I love my wife with my heart, my soul. She frequently asks me, how important is this vaccine issue to you? Because I think she would really like that $1.7 million. We barely pay our bills each week or each month in the clinic. It's that important. And it is what it is. So we're going to keep going as long as we can survive as a clinic. Each month it's hit or miss, and those are the rules that we have to play by, but the kids are more important than the money. If you don't know, it's hard to be held accountable. For sure, pediatricians who don't own their own clinics don't understand the financial ramifications of a lower vaccine rate. Physicians, including a provider at one of my previous practices, realize that if you have to talk about vaccines, you lose money. If you give the vaccines and it didn't take you any time to talk about it, you optimize your profit for you personally as a provider, but also for the organization. If you spend 10 or 15 minutes talking about a vaccine and a family chooses not to vaccinate after they have informed consent, you lose 15 minutes of your productivity for the day, and you certainly don't make a profit for the vaccine. So when physicians haven't read about vaccines, I understand it, right? We're busy, and we hope that we can just put some of these things at ease, right? If you have asthma, you need an inhaler. You know, if you have eczema, you need a steroid. Let's just use the protocol. Let's use the algorithm. Let's provide care that we learned. And I don't judge that at all. Vaccines are different because we're making recommendations suggesting that they're perfectly safe, and they're not. And we're hurting kids, but we won't know it or admit it unless we read. My hope is that physicians, under the pressure of parents, will stop and actually read about it. They'll read some great books that are out there. They'll actually go to peer-reviewed research and study the vaccine ingredients, as opposed to what the pharmaceutical representative hands you when they're selling you the vaccine.
Wow. Right, so, you know, I hate to say this, it sounds kind of mean, but it is true, I feel, that they, pediatricians, and please, it's just from what I've heard going around, they are pharma sales reps. Because you're prescribing inhalers, antibiotics, drugs. When does any pediatrician ever say, you know what, you need to go home, you need to have some vitamin C, you need to drink plenty of fluid, just like the doctors used to do in my day, that was what they did. And all we hear from the parents is, oh, give them Tylenol, and take a course of antibiotics while you're at it, and here's an antidepressant for you, Mum. So we're hearing.
It's what we learn in medical school, mm-hmm. and we're medical doctors, and we're infallible. When we received our medical degree, we inherited the wealth of the knowledge of the universe, and at that moment, we knew more than anybody. And it's very scary to think that that isn't true. Now, not every doctor feels that way, but I would hazard to guess many do in my interactions, in my experiences. And so if we step back and we realize that not everything needs a medicine or a surgery, that maybe our bodies are designed pretty perfectly and we can step back and let our bodies heal, or we can look at other options, such as time, or hugs and kisses, or maybe a warm bath, and move beyond that. I think that many physicians would be surprised that they don't need the medicine. And on a business side, you can make almost as much money, which is pretty cool too. You make a little bit more money if you prescribe a medicine, but ultimately it's about providing care. And so we can just step back and humble ourselves and serve.
I have a suggestion.
Oh, wonderful.
Because it'll be impressive enough. The fact that this child has not gotten any immunizations previously means this poor child will have to be tortured with six different injections at the same time. And if you would like to put those six up at the one visit, at her first visit to get all these immunizations, I'm happy to do that.
A child at their six-month shot, they would receive DTaP, correct?
Correct.
They would receive polio?
Correct.
Hep B?
Correct.
Pneumococcal?
Yes.
HIV?
It depends. It depends on the product that was used in the first two sessions.
Same issue with catching up a two-and-a-half-year-old, right? Same choice.
Same choice. Yeah, in this case, yes.
At 2.5 years of age, you're saying getting six vaccines is torture, but a six-month-old would have to receive, we just counted, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 vaccines, correct? Aluminum adjuvants are used in vaccines, correct?
Correct.
Why are aluminum adjuvants used in vaccines?
Because they make the vaccine more effective.
Okay. And how do they do that?
I don't know.
Okay. What's an antigen?
An antigen is typically a protein that, in this case, it would be, if you're talking about vaccines, an antigen is a protein that causes a reaction and oftentimes is an infectious agent, but not always.
Isn't it true that an adjuvant will not only bind to the target antigen that's in the vaccine, but also to the impurities and byproducts such as the animal and human parts left in the vaccine or the manufacturing process?
You're asking me specifics about physiology that I am not, that's not my area of expertise.
But so you're not aware that there's a difference between the form that aluminum, so when it's ingested, taken up in ionic form, when it's injected, it's in these nanoparticle forms. And in contrast, injected aluminum are nanoparticles, correct? They're there to create an irritant to the immune system so that the vaccine creates antibodies. And so they're actually these nanoparticles that are in the vaccine, right? Or do you not know?
You're talking about specifics that are very detailed.
Aren't the details important? I mean, you said that...
Not in this case, because we're talking about a metal. It is not concerning to me because the amount of aluminum that we ingest in general, just through our diet, is much higher than what we get through vaccines. There's no reason to believe that that additional small amount is anything to be concerned about.
Now, this is something the pharmaceutical companies will never tell you. But anything injected goes straight into the circulation. It goes to vital organs. There's a great study on aluminum, which shows that 95%+ is absorbed in the body tissues. When you eat something, when you drink something, when you inhale something, 95% of that is filtered out through our body's natural detox processes. So anything you inject is going to be far, far more dangerous and far more potent.
So you said that the quantity of ingested aluminum is small, or excuse me, is much larger than the amount of injected aluminum, and therefore you deem it safe.
Correct.
Are you aware that the FDA provides that in terms of ingested aluminum, eaten aluminum, 0.3% or less is actually taken up by the blood? Do you know that or not?
I don't know the exact numbers now.
And that if it is, it's taken up in ionic form. Do you understand what I mean?
I understand what you mean by that.
That means in its smallest elemental form, that's how it's taken into the blood, right?
Correct.
Okay. And aluminum in ionic form is not able to cross the blood-brain barrier, correct?
I am not aware that that's true.
You don't know?
I don't know that that's true.
Okay. If you don't know, that's fine. And antigens bound to aluminum are taken up by macrophages, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And macrophages present the stuff they gobble up to the parts of the immune system that create antibodies, correct?
I believe so. I have not studied the actual mechanism of action.
And they also travel to different parts of the body, including
correct.
The brain, correct?
Correct.
And they'll deposit the materials they gobble up there. Isn't it true that most package inserts for most vaccines report encephalitis or encephalopathy as a reported adverse event from vaccination?
I would have to look at all the package inserts to be able to say yes or no to that. It is possible, yes.
Do any of the vaccines in the childhood study contain monkey kidney cells?
I do not know.
Blood serum from cows?
I do not know.
Guinea pig cell cultures?
I do not know.
Gelatin from pigs and cows?
I don't know.
MRC5 human diploid cells?
MRC5 human diploid cells. Those are specifics that I typically do not.
Are you aware that MRC5 diploid cells are cells cultured from the lung tissue in an aborted fetus?
I am aware that there are two vaccines out on the market, the MMR and the VZV, that have that use a cell in the production of it, use a cell line from aborted fetuses from 1962 and 1966. Those are the only two aborted fetus tissue cell lines that are used.
Isn't it true that there actually has recently been a new cell line, human cell line from aborted fetal tissue that's been approved for use in vaccines?
I am not aware of that.
Okay. And none of the aborted fetal tissue culture cell lines actually end up in the vaccine product?
The vaccine doesn't have cells in it.
The cellular pieces from the aborted fetal
that is potentially possible, yes.
Okay. Isn't it true that, in fact, there is more of that cellular debris in the MMR, for example, than there is actually antigen?
I don't know.
Okay. Isn't it true that the hepatitis A vaccine contains millions of fragments of human DNA?
Possible? I don't know.
Isn't it true that Varivax, the chickenpox vaccine, contains approximately 1 trillion fragments of human DNA?
Again, if Dr. Plotkin says it does, then I will agree.
Isn't it true that these 74 aborted fetuses had almost every piece of their bodies, including skin, tongue, and heart, cut into little cubes to be used for culture?
I'm not aware of any studies that Dr. Plotkin, the specifics of any studies that Dr. Plotkin did.
What principles and methods did you rely upon in reaching your opinion regarding vaccine safety?
I used the recommendations of the CDC and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and the American Academy of Pediatrics to form an opinion about the vaccine safety.
So your basis. So I'm saying the principle and methods that you relied upon in reaching your opinion regarding vaccine safety and vaccine efficacy are what the CDC recommends and and your claim that you've seen some people die of some diseases that for which there are vaccinations. Is that correct?
Correct.
That's the sum total, right?
And the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations.
Okay.
So when you're looking at a patient and making the determination as to what vaccines they should receive, what family history factors are concerning to you?
One of the big family history factors that I would take into consideration is there a history of anybody who's immune suppressed?
Isn't it true that the only polio vaccine used in the United States is an activated polio vaccine, which is injected in muscle?
It's an inactivated poliovirus vaccine.
Right, and it's injected in muscle tissue.
Correct.
Okay. Versus what we used to be using.
Actually, it's not into the muscle tissue. It's given sub-Q, typically.
I've been studying vaccines for close to 17 years. I'm not really here to speak against or for vaccines. I am for the legislation. What I'm here to speak about is for science. And I think in all of this discussion, what I'm hearing is an attempt to get you legislators to pay attention to science. And I'm advising you and asking you to look at the science and not at the rhetoric. You have a very difficult task, which I empathize with, which is you have to try to make sense of the very august and respected institutions represented by pediatrics, the Department of Health, which are advising you that these medical interventions are safe and effective. Unfortunately, if you look at the science, you will not find the evidence to support those conclusions. Please look at the evidence. The days of Marcus Welby are over. We cannot just listen and take what our doctors say with blind faith anymore. And please don't do that. Don't listen to what you hear in this room today, except that it might inspire you to learn on your own what the truth is about vaccines.
That's
part of the truth that you will learn is that much of the outcomes have not been researched. We do not know the long-term effects of vaccination because they have not been researched. Why not? I think you can guess why not. How interested are the vaccine companies in finding out the answers to those questions? What independent research will be funded that will answer those questions? There has been some research done which indicates that those cohorts of children who have been fully vaccinated have a higher incidence of chronic illness than those cohorts that do not. This does not diminish the value of the vaccine in reducing the incidence of infectious disease. However, we are reducing the incidence of infectious disease with one stroke and increasing the incidence of chronic illness on the other. This is science. I'm not making this up. Okay? So, when I was in medical school, I was taught, don't talk about the bad side effects. You're going to scare the patient. If that's what you want your doctors to do, you should believe the doctors in the room who have told you there are no serious side effects.
Thank you, doctor. Doctor, I just have a quick question. You said you're into the science aspect of the right. The medical practice. Are you an MD or are you a scientist? Or
I'm an MD.
You're an MD?
Yes.
And you specialize in the science of the medicine? Is that what it is?
Well, I would like to think all of us doctors go to the science, advise people based on science. In our medical training, we actually do not get training on the science of vaccination. That is not part of medical training.
Oh, okay.
And those people who say, and there have been people who said this, you should trust the doctors. They have the training. They have not received training in vaccination. That is not done in medical school or residency, and I would ask you to find a pediatrician who says they've been well educated in the science of vaccines. They aren't.
would assume that our Department of Health, there are certain vaccinations that, you know, that we want our children to have that would be required.
I ask people to investigate each and every vaccine on its own merits. I my own pediatrician, for my own children, he has allowed my children not to be vaccinated above and beyond what my wife had asked, but he says that he assumes that the CDC and the health department would not be recommending these vaccines if they were not safe and effective. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, if you look at the evidence, you will find that assumption to be unwarranted. Do the research. You will find the evidence does not support that assumption. It's nice in Marcus Welby world to believe that it is warranted. It is not warranted. The CDC has been shown to be extremely corrupt, and much of the research was done. Researchers were paid to find certain outcomes that the CDC wanted, and when the outcomes weren't obtained, they suppressed that data. It's really outrageous how far we've come from science with this. Follow the science. Don't believe what I'm saying or anybody else. Follow the science.
Thank you, Doctor.
Ironically and humorously, ABC News reported that parents who don't vaccinate kids tend to be affluent and better educated, experts say. And this comes as Washington is in a state of emergency amid a measles outbreak. This reported January 29th, 2019. The outbreak is about 35 people. Now, the article, of course, starts out with a complete lie, according to the very quotes that we just read. Vaccines are universally backed by respected scientists and federal agencies. Those ignorant or bought and paid for, I suppose. But that isn't enough to convince every parent to vaccinate their children. The decision to fly in the face of near universal scientific opinion, two words that don't really belong together, science and opinion, doesn't come as a result of lack of intellect. However, as experts who have studied vaccines and immunology acknowledge that many parents who don't vaccinate their children are, in fact, well educated. They also appear to be the victims of a widespread misinformation campaign, the so-called experts said. Daniel Salmon, who is the director of the Institute of Vaccine Safety at Johns Hopkins University, said that existing research suggests that there are some common attributes that many parents who choose not to vaccinate their children share. He said, quote, "They tend to be better educated. They tend to be white. They tend to be higher income. They tend to have larger families, and they tend to use complementary and alternative medicine like chiropractors and naturopaths." Peter Hotez, a vaccine advocate and dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Bayer College of Medicine, said that, quote, "We need a lot more social science data about the specific characteristics of those who opt against vaccinations, but he agreed that they tend to be affluent and educated. For example, Washington State, which is now in a state of emergency because of the ongoing measles outbreak, has the 11th highest college completion rate according to the USDA's Economic Research Service data from 2011 to 2015. Now, we have to realize that measles is a natural disease that's been going on for thousands and thousands of years, not just a couple months. And that a few dozen people catching the measles is not, in fact, an emergency or epidemic. It's actually quite natural. Science Daily reports in August 20th, 2020, that defiance and low trust in medical doctors is also related to vaccine skepticism. A new study shows that individuals who react negatively to rules and recommendations and have lower trust in doctors more often use complementary and alternative medicine, that is, treatments or substances that are not included in the care offered or recommended by doctors. Imagine that. The results of this study show that people who tend to react negatively to rules and recommendations have lower trust in medical doctors and a more negative attitude towards vaccines, or reject vaccines for themselves or their children. The vaccine recommendations given by authorities or the social pressure in society to get vaccinated may cause defiance in people who tend to react negatively when they feel that they are forced to do something or that someone is trying to persuade them. Because of this defiance, people may act contrary to what is expected of them. In this case, defiance can lead to skepticism towards medical doctors and negative attitudes towards vaccines or even vaccine refusal. The study also showed that defiance and low trust in doctors are related to a higher likelihood to use complementary and alternative medicine. These are treatments and substances that are not included in evidence-based medicine, meaning treatments and substances for which the efficacy has not been clearly demonstrated through established scientific methods. But don't be fooled by that lie. To use complementary and alternative medicine may be a way for people to feel like they are free to make decisions in matters that concern their own health. Science Daily also reported in January of 2018 that patients react better when doctors imply uncertainty rather than state it directly. This out of Oxford University Press. A choice of words might matter when doctors communicate uncertainty of diagnosis to their patients. A new article shows that the parents of pediatric patients may react more negatively to doctors who communicate uncertainty of diagnosis explicitly, such as directly stating they are unsure, as compared to doctors who use implicit language, such as discussing most likely diagnosis or providing several possible diagnoses under consideration. Choice of words might matter when doctors communicate uncertainty of diagnosis to their patients. A paper published in the International Journal for Quality in Healthcare shows that the parents of pediatric patients may react more negatively to doctors who communicate uncertainty of diagnosis explicitly, such as directly stating they are unsure, as compared to doctors who use implicit language, such as discussing most likely diagnosis or providing several possible diagnoses under consideration. Diagnostic uncertainty is widespread in clinical practice, and physician guidelines generally recommend that doctors explain the degree of uncertainty associated with their diagnosis. However, how exactly doctors should communicate uncertainty is a matter of debate. This communication can lower visit satisfaction, decrease adherence to doctor instructions, lessen trust, and decrease confidence in the doctor. So if a doctor tells you the truth that he doesn't know, which, not ironically, the Hippocratic Oath demands, the doctor might lose face with the patient? In other words, honesty is somehow not the best policy when diagnosing a disease? The researchers have surveyed parents of pediatric patients who hypothetically received a diagnosis with an element of uncertainty. The uncertainty in the diagnosis was communicated in one of three ways, either with an explicit expression of uncertainty, such as, I'm not sure which disease this is, an implicit expression of uncertainty using broad differential diagnosis, such as, it could be this disease or this other disease, or another implicit expression of uncertainty, such as, it is most likely this disease. Researchers found that explicit expressions of uncertainty were associated with lower perceived technical competence of the doctor, less trust and confidence, and a less willingness to adhere to doctors' advice. Well, no wonder doctors sound so confident when they're recommending vaccines, which they know nothing about. Misdiagnosis is common in medical practice, and to enable improvements, uncertainty of diagnosis is something both doctors and patients will need to embrace, said Hardeep Singh, MD, MPH, senior author and researcher at the Houston Veterans Affairs Center for Innovations in Quality, Effectiveness, and Safety at Baylor College of Medicine. Our study provides a foundation for future development of evidence-based guidance on how doctors can best communicate diagnostic uncertainty to patients to improve diagnosis and care outcomes. In other words, when the doctor doesn't know what the disease is, he shouldn't let on to the patient that he has absolutely no idea what he's doing? This, of course, is a perfect example of corporate influence and greed. After all, medicine in the form of drug sales is now nothing but big business. The point that is being made here is that doctors should literally lie or use flowery language when diagnosing their patients. The lack of confidence in the diagnosis would mean that the patient might not accept the prescribed drugs or vaccines issued by an uncertain doctor in his diagnosis. A mortal drug or a deadly drug is poison. And unfortunately, that describes just about all drugs, which is why you take certain dosages so as not to overdose or poison yourself. A drug is a drudge. And to drug means to season with drugs or ingredients, to tincture or taint with something offensive. In other words, to corrupt the blood. Knowing that the word inoculation literally translates to the word harm or infection, we come to the word infect. To taint or corrupt with disease, to infuse into a healthy body the virus, that is, pus, miasma, or morbid matter of a deceased body, or any pestilential or noxious air or substance by which a disease is produced. Persons in health are infected by the contagion of the plague, of syphilis, of smallpox, of measles, of malignant fevers. In some cases, persons can be infected only by contact, as in syphilis, but in most cases they may be infected without contact with the diseased body. To taint or affect with morbid or noxious matter. To infect a lancet, and then, of course, stick that into the human body, to infect clothing or infect an apartment. To communicate bad qualities to corrupt, to taint by the communication of anything noxious or pernicious. It is melancholy to see the young infected and corrupted by vicious examples, or the minds of our citizens infected with errors. And boy, are we infected. A corruption of blood, a corruption of body, mind, and soul. Our government and the medical profession is indeed contaminated with illegalities. Obviously, the word infection is the act of infecting, or the morbid cause which excites disease in a healthy or uninfected body, and that is, of course, the purpose of drugs and vaccines. This cause may be contagion from a diseased body or other poisonous or noxious matter received into the body or under the skin, that is, by inoculation, in other words, purposeful harm. Infection is used in two acceptations, first as denoting the effluvium, or the infectious matter exhaled from the person of one diseased, in which sense it is synonymous with contagion, and secondly as signifying the act of communication of such morbid effluvium by which disease is transferred. Infection is that which taints, poisons, or corrupts by communication from one to another. When we speak of the integrity of the human and animal bodies, when left alone, as designed in nature, there is only one thing that can cause dis-ease, or a lack of integrity, and that is corruption. And we find that same concept in the medical and pharmaceutical and governmental structures, mass and almost unspeakable corruption. To corrupt, literally, is to break or to separate, to dissolve, and that's where compartmentalization or specialization comes in, where doctors know very little about anything but what they specialize in. To corrupt anything means to change that thing or the body from a sound to a putrid or putrescent state, to separate the component parts of a body as by a natural process. Unfortunately, that is what happens when the immune system is attacked by such drugs and vaccines, where it is either no longer able to protect the body from infection or begins attacking itself in an autoimmune syndrome. To corrupt is to vitiate or deprave, to change from good to bad. To waste, to spoil, or consume, to defile, to pollute. To entice from good, an allure to evil, to pervert, to break, to disobey, to make void, to pervert or vitiate integrity, to bribe, to debase or render impure by alterations or innovations, in other words, compounds, inoculations, as to corrupt language, to pervert, to falsify, to infect with errors, as to corrupt the sacred text. What is a more sacred text than your own DNA, which is being infected and corrupted in a level you can't even imagine, but you're going to see in this documentary presentation? As an adjective, to be corrupt is to be changed from a sound to a putrid state, to be spoiled, tainted, vitiated, unsound as corruption, to be depraved, vitiated, and tainted with wickedness, to be debased, rendered impure, changed to a worse state, and finally to be not genuine, in other words, not human, infected with errors or mistakes. Well, yeah, if you infect the human body with parts of a cow, you're no longer only human, you're corrupted by the disease of other animals. This is vaccination. And just what is it to be vaccinated, inoculated, or harmed with the cow pox? That's it. That was what was known as being vaccinated back then. And here again we come to the word effluvium, or the plural effluvia, from the Latin effluo, to flow out, from the word flow. Effluvium is defined as the minute and often invisible particles which exhale from most, if not all, terrestrial bodies, such as the odor or smell of plants and the noxious exhalations from diseased bodies or putrefying animals or vegetable substances. The effluence of such particles is the flow or the flowing out of that disease, that which flows or issues from any body or substance. One of the most often used ingredients in the vaccination and drug process is the serum of cows and other animals. Serum is the thin, transparent part of the blood, the thin part of milk or whey. Coming from the word serous, thin, watery, or like whey, used of that part of the blood which separates in coagulation from the grumous or red part pertaining to the serum. And again, this is how our blood is corrupted by foreign serum. Serosity is the watery part of the blood. Through this inoculation process of serums and other substances, pus, venom, poisons to corrupt the body and the blood, what we're really talking about is a perversion of nature. To be anti-vaccination is to be pro-nature. To be pro-vaccination is to be anti-nature. To pervert is to turn from the truth, to cause something to be proprietary or property, to turn it from its proper purpose, to distort from its true use or end, as to pervert reason by misdirecting it, to pervert the laws by misinterpreting and misapplying them, to pervert justice, to pervert the meaning of an author, and to pervert nature, to pervert truth. Nature and truth are indeed the same words. To pervert is to turn from the right, to corrupt. Now it is very important to understand that this term proprietary or property is used. And of course that word is at the very heart of the money-making scandal that is the medical and pharmaceutical industries. The patenting process of these novel or unique drug compounds that are created by the pharmaceutical companies become their property, their perversion. You see, nothing that comes from nature, or for the religious-minded, nothing that is a creation of God, nothing that is truth, can be patented. However, when something is perverted, changed, altered, once it is no longer natural, once it is no longer truth, once it is corrupted, only then can that thing be patented and delivered by doctors and nurses through prescription. To be something that is perverse means to be turned aside, hence distorted from being right. To be obstinate in the wrong, to be disposed to be contrary, as in to be contrary to truth or to health. To suggest that the medical and pharmaceutical industry, as well as the government agencies that protect them, are perverse, is the understatement of the century. All of this, of course, relies on contagion. To be poisoned is to have a contagion. Literally, to touch or the touching of something. Hence, the communication of a disease by contact or the matter communicated, the pus communicated. More generally, that subtle matter which proceeds from a diseased person or body and communicates the disease to another person, as in cases of smallpox, measles, anginas, and malignant fevers, diseases which are communicated without contact. This contagion proceeds from the breath of the diseased, from the perspiration and other excretions. That which communicates evil from one to another, or infection, inoculation, that which propagates mischief, as the contagion of vice or of evil examples, pestilence, a pestilential disease, venomous exhalations, effluvium. To be something contagious means to be containing or generating contagion, catching, that may be communicated by contact or by a subtle excreted matter or pus as a contagious disease. To be poisonous, as all drugs are, pestilential, containing contagion as contagious air or clothing, containing mischief that may be propagated, or that which may be communicated from one to another or may excite like affections in others. And finally, we reach the end goal of such corruption, such contagion, such purposeful inoculation or infection, harm caused to people, and that is the conversion process. We are converted when we are infected. Our bodies, our epigenomic and genomic structures are converted by this contagion, by this inoculation, this purposeful harm, this purposeful spread of disease. Conversion, in a general sense, means a turning or a change from one state to another. For instance, to change from healthy cells to cancerous cells. With regard to substances, transmutation as a conversion of water into ice or of food into chyle or blood. And that brings us to the concept of seroconversion. Remember, sero comes from the word serum, or the clear part of the blood. Seroconversion, for instance, is a common term used in the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Seroconversion refers to the transition from infection with HIV to the detectable presence of HIV antibodies in the blood. When seroconversion occurs, usually within a few weeks of infection, the result of an HIV antibody test changes from HIV negative to HIV positive. This represents the seroconversion, the blood conversion, the corruption of the blood with HIV. Amazingly, that's exactly what a vaccine would do. A purposeful infection of HIV into the body, an inoculation causing HIV positive response antibodies. Who's going to step up and get that vaccine? And this seroconversion relates to all vaccines. For instance, at the MerckVaccines.com website, we find that in clinical trials, the MMR vaccine demonstrated high seroconversion rates after the first dose. This is referring to the antibody response created by purposeful infection, by inoculation of a disease through the process of what we today call vaccination. No differently than it would have been to purposefully cut open the skin and insert cow pus right into the body. To be clear, the only indicator of a successful vaccine is the measured response of antibodies or a seroconversion of the blood, literally a corruption of the blood as expressed through the antibody response. That's it. Vaccines have no other intent. They do not cure, they do not cause immunity, they do not do anything but cause seroconversion. And that does not in any way prevent disease. Clinical studies of 284 triple seronegative children 11 months to 7 years of age demonstrated that MMR vaccine is highly immunogenic. We find this corruptive seroconversion to be a well-understood concept in vaccination, and we can find this seroconversion or blood conversion process or corruption of blood in every vaccination study. Seroconversion in endemic parainfluenza 3 positive breeding colony was studied in 2002 and indicated that pups became infected from 2 weeks to 8 weeks of age. The virus did not persist as sentinels exposed to 4 to 5 month old seropositive animals did not seroconvert. Experimental infections indicate that seroconversion in naive animals occurs approximately 10 days following infection. In an infection study, guinea pigs inoculated, vaccinated with cavian parainfluenza virus 3 or simian virus 5, SV5, murine pneumonia virus or bovine parainfluenza virus developed no clinical signs of disease or lesions during the 8-week course of the study, although they developed robust homologous or heterologous serologic responses to a majority of the antigens. In primary HIV infection, seroconversion, i.e. the documented first appearance of HIV antibodies in the serum, in the blood, occurs days after the beginning of the symptoms of PHI. Therefore, the usual antibody tests for HIV are not entirely reliable. They are expected to be negative during the first few days. Assays differ in the duration of this seronegative period. With the currently used sensitive tests, it is usually less than 1 week after the start of symptoms of PHI. Another example of seroconversion happens with toxoplasmosis, of which the CDC warns that 40% of the population is infected. This is a brain parasite. In toxoplasmosis, once seroconversion occurs, IgG or immunoglobulin G antibodies essentially persist for the life of the affected person. Thus, the prevalence of antibodies increases with increasing age and the proportion of uninfected persons decreases. And in this report from the CDC, we find that seroconversion to simian immunodeficiency virus in 2 laboratory workers took place. SIVs are lentiviruses that cause acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, AIDS-like illnesses, in susceptible macaque monkeys, and are used in the study of AIDS. In November 1988, the CDC published guidelines to minimize the risk of SIV transmission to research laboratory workers. This report summarizes the investigation of 2 laboratory workers who seroconverted following occupational exposure to SIV. Essentially, in this report, we find these men infected by sticking themselves with an SIV or simian immunodeficiency virus blood-contaminated needle while practicing their scientific studies. To be converted is to be turned or changed from one substance or state to another. And what often happens in these autoimmune diseases is that the body is actually controverted. To be controvert is to be turned against, to dispute, to oppose, to be turned or changed from one substance or state to another, as the corruption of blood. And therefore your body literally opposes itself. In other words, it creates antibodies against your own body, against your own bodily functions. This is called autoimmune disease. It is literally a controversion, or a turning to the opposite side. But then what would you do if you suddenly had cow proteins trying to rearrange the DNA in your body? And so, when the DNA and protein structures of foreign animals, plants, and insects are injected into your body, your body's natural response is seroconversion. We've all been controverted from our natural state of health.